to the teardown, baby.
We swarm.
Welcome to the teardown.
We swarm. Let them know.
We swarm, baby.
We swarm, baby. All day long.
We about to win so big. Talking about hydraulic money.
Coming in, tell me what's the program. 25 bags of crush, yeah, get with the program. Shorty want that wave, get the program. Shorty want that wave, what's the program? Throwing through the air, what's the program? Fucking
ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Another week, another episode of Tales from the Terror Dome. It's your boy Dan. Got another one, good one for y'all tonight. You know, it's the off-season, baby, interview season in full effect, bringing back all the hokey greats, man. And, you know, so we got to show love to special teams because they are important. If you watched Iowa football this year, you saw how important that punter was. Definitely big reason why they won 10 games. But tonight, I got a multi-time Ray Guy Award semifinalist. This man averaged 39.4 yards per punt. He had over 7,000 yards in his career through the air with his leg. His name's Vinny Burns, and he's in the pod, man. How you doing?
Hey, Dan, how are you doing? Thanks for having me on here. I'm really excited. Happy to speak to the Hokie Nation, and thank you for putting this together for us and all the former Hokies that are lucky enough to do this.
Yeah, man, absolutely. You know, I said your career long was 63 yards. That's a long-ass punt, man.
You know,
that's my real question is, you see all these big boosts you got, and then it's like your average yard per punt was 39.4. So I guess, do they count the return? They factor the return into that number, or how does that work? I mean, 40 yards is still, like, impressive, but I just didn't know how that worked exactly.
No, they don't factor the return in. What they factor in is basically from the line of scrimmage to the catch, where the person caught the punt. I did do a decent amount of pooch punting or just hitting the ball really high to enforce a hang, to kind of force a fair catch. So that might be why my average is a little low, but I did enjoy when I could just have a big field to work with and just really rip into a ball and drive them really far.
But I mean, like, I'm not saying 40 yards is little because I can't punt the ball 40 yards. So, like, that's impressive to me.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's, you know, punting is one of those skills that I understand why it can be overlooked because it seems like the player doesn't have a lot to do. They kind of come in, they just, you know, spend 3 or 4 seconds on a field and trot off. But it's definitely a difficult skill to learn. If anyone's out there try to punt or go out and try to punt, you'll realize to hit what you want is challenging. It's not hard to swing your leg and hit a ball, but to put it where you want to put it or put it with a certain amount of hang time or to put it in this corner or even just to get it to spiral can be a challenging endeavor. But you work hard at it, and like anything else in life, you can achieve it.
Does it hurt every time you punt the ball?
No, not at all. Not going to lie, it does hurt in those very cold months. Like, I remember I played in a game where it was 17 degrees with snow flurries in Blacksburg. And since we're not moving around that much in the field, like a field player, every time you hit the ball, it feels like you're just trying to punt a brick as hard as you can. So that can sting. You'll definitely feel that. But we do a little bit of things to cheat, like put a hand warmer, you know, in our cleat to kind of keep our foot a little warm and loosened up. But there's still no replacing impacting a football in sub-20-degree weather as hard as you can.
Yeah, nah, but, like, I watch, like, Pat McAfee punt footballs, and you hear it. Like, you hear, like, that, like, the not only the contact, but, like, the recoil from, like, the hammy and the plant leg and everything. And it just sounds like it doesn't feel the best.
Oh, no. Oh, no. It's It's akin to taking 2 steps and just punching something really hard. And at some point,
punches hurt.
Punches do hurt. They can hurt. Even if you had a thin glove on, you're still going to feel it. And it's kind of no different. So, yeah, it can be a little tough, but it's still a fun thing to do. I tell people sometimes, it's like if you play golf And when you go to a driving range and you really work on your game, after a few years, you just go to a driving range and you can tee off on a ball and crush it. And it feels a really smooth swing. That's what punting feels like. You tee a ball up, you just hit it as hard as you can and it flies off. And, you know, honestly, you feel kind of proud of yourself when you see it just drifting off into the sky.
And you know immediately once you hit once it makes contact that you got it. You either got a hold of it really well or it's going to be, everyone's going to hate you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if you hit it very sweet and sweet spot with just every technique right possible, you don't even have to look at it. You can just hit it and just know it's gone. And you can walk right back around and load up for the next ball coming in.
I got you. So you're telling me the first couple times you ever punted a football, there was no tenderness?
There was a lot of tenderness. And I have a story about the first time I punted a football. So I'm from New Orleans, Louisiana. And I went to a high school named St. Augustine High School, which is a well-known high school down here. We actually have the most NFL players from Louisiana in NFL. I think with 34, the next closest team is 18. But that includes people like Leonard Fournette, Tyrann Mathieu, a lot of people that have gone on and played.
Honey Badger
in college and pro level. So it's a great high school. It's an all-male, all-black, Catholic private high school. And when I got there in 1996, there was not a soccer team. I played soccer my entire life before I got to high school. But I wanted to kick something. So I went out to kick footballs. And I remember going out there, not knowing much about football whatsoever. But as you can imagine, with a team that doesn't have a soccer team, kicking is not that big of a issue or not big of a thing that people really put a lot of emphasis on. So I maybe hit 10 balls. I was 14, maybe 140 pounds. And after the 10th ball I hit, they said, great, you're starting on varsity. First game is in 2 weeks in the Superdome. And I was like, wait, hold up. This is a lot more than park ball soccer that I'm used to with my mom and family on the sidelines feeding us orange slices at halftime. So I had to learn how to wear pads, rules of the game. And I was so nervous about punting. And I was not good at punting at that stage of my career. The very first punt I had, I'm in the Superdome with 20,000 people around me, where the Saints play, and the first ball snapped to me was dribbled back to me. It didn't even make it to my hands. And I remember bending down to pick this ball up, and I made the mistake which punters shouldn't do. I looked up before I got the ball, and I saw these big, massive dudes rushing towards me. And I just put the ball back on the ground, kicked it like a soccer ball, and ran the other way. And everyone started laughing. The referee threw a flag. I think it's the first illegal kick in Louisiana history. I went home very upset and told my dad, I don't want to play football anymore. And this is not for me. And, you know, I didn't plan to make this team and be on varsity in 2 weeks. And so back to what you said, kicking the ball for the first time can be very challenging, especially if you're thrust into playing for a high profile team in a position that you're not comfortable with.
Yeah, you were back there. You saw them people coming. You said, psych, and you got out of town.
Yeah, I got out of there. I wasn't used to all that. So I just got on my high horse and sprinted towards my own end zone. And yeah, I mean, my whole team had a field day laughing at me for about 2 weeks in practice. But
I bet.
But you know, I went to a lot of camps after that season. And that season, I might have averaged 34, 35 yards. And I went to a bunch of camps, worked my butt off. And my last camp that I went to, going into my senior year, was hosted at LSU by a guy named Bill Renner, who punted for Virginia Tech. And I went to that camp. I didn't want to go because I'd been to three camps before that summer. And for those that don't know or haven't been to a kicking camp or kick, it's imagine going to pitching camp if you played baseball. So for 3 days straight, you're just throwing balls as hard as you can, and your arm gets very, very tired. And you do three camps like that in the summer, and your arm's kind of blown out. So my leg was very, very tired. And I told my dad, I said, look, I'm not really sure I want to make this camp because I'm really, really tired. And I think I've done pretty good. I've learned a lot. I'm kind of ready for my senior year. And he said, well, you know, you never know what happens. You should put yourself in front of many people as you can. You need to go to this camp. So I go, and I had the best camp I've ever had. I mean, I was just hitting balls left and right, very far. Anything they asked, I was a standout competitor in that camp. So toward the end of the camp, the coaches always pull everyone up individually and kind of give them a report on how they did, what they should work on, X, Y, Z. And Coach Renner pulled me to the side and said, look, I played at Virginia Tech. They have a fantastic punter named Jimmy Kibble who's going to his senior year of college, and they're going to want to recruit someone for next season. And you're the best punter I've seen this year. So I would imagine they would assume you would go to a state school like LSU down here or somewhere in the South, but I want to put you on their radar and have them start recruiting you. And I was over the moon. I mean, I had not known anything about Virginia Tech outside of my dad being on a Sugar Bowl committee and Virginia Tech playing Texas. And, you know, as a young kid, I would go with my dad to the practices and I would watch, you know, the players practice and everything. And that's the extent of what I knew about Virginia Tech. But that year, thankfully, I was a senior. I was a high school All-American. And that's the same year Virginia Tech went to the national championship. So it all worked out perfectly. And I'm really thankful I went to that camp. I'm very thankful for Coach Renner and the opportunity I had to play for the Hokies.
So who recruited you from Tech? Like, who made the trip to Louisiana to convince you to come to Blacksburg?
The one and only Coach Bud Foster.
Oh, it was Bud?
Yes, sir.
Oh, man. I'm sure he couldn't wait to get to New Orleans.
Well, I had my mom and my family make up some good Louisiana Creole food for him. And so he did not mind making a trip to come check in and recruit. But it was great. I mean, you know, playing special teams at Virginia Tech is such an honor because of Beamer ball, obviously. But, you know, if a school is known for one thing, let's say a school is known for just producing the best running backs. Well, then obviously coming out of high school, you want to go to college because that is the one place anyone that played that position will want to go to. So I felt very honored that I was one being recruited and that I was, you know, in a sense, worthy enough to go play at Virginia Tech for such an amazing university and program led by Coach Beamer and Coach Foster.
Yeah. Who else was recruiting you? Like, what other schools were like hitting you up?
I was recruited by Duke, Clemson, University of South Florida, I think a couple of small Louisiana schools. So, you know, kind of what Coach Renner was saying, you know, schools in the South really kind of recruit me more than schools up north or anywhere else. And this is back in 1999, 2000, where you kind of really stuck toward your regional area of people you recruited and got in touch with. So I was, again, very thankful that Coach Renner reached out to Virginia Tech and put me on their radar and really got me an opportunity to go there.
Yeah, man. So, I mean, so you're going from, it's, you know, it's 99, you know, you're getting ready to go to Blacksburg. You're coming from New Orleans. Cash money taking over for the 99 and the 2000s. You got all the food, all the culture, everything. And you come to Blacksburg, Virginia. What was that like for you when you showed up and you had to have been like, oh my God.
Yeah, there was a 2 week period where I wasn't second guessing my decision. I just, it took a while for me to wrap my head around. I'm in a completely different element than I'm comfortable in. And it's not a bad thing. It's just different. Like completely different. I wasn't a big partier when I was in high school. I was more of like a student body president, you know, all American football player, all honors classes, kind of student athlete. Although, you know, I have a lot of friends and people that partied a lot in New Orleans because that's what people really do in New Orleans is party a lot. But it just kind of wasn't my life. So when I got to Tech, a lot of people assumed I partied all the time, but I really didn't. I mean, I really didn't even drink till I got to college. So it was an experience, not just from that part, but just the discipline, how big the program was, how disciplined everyone had to be, the expectation of professionalism that was expected of you. And quite honestly, being on a campus away from your immediate network of people, and that includes friends and family, but also like your parents. You know, as I said, I was an all honors student going all through high school, but truth be told, I think my first semester, I had like a 1.8 because I couldn't manage being like no one forcing me to go to class or get up or do anything. There was no accountability that I had learned at that point. But, you know, after Coach Beamer pulled me to the side and had a very stern conversation with me about their expectations and my ability to play or not play if I don't get my stuff together. I turned that around and became a lot better student side of the student athlete.
Yeah, I bet. That's kind of funny that Frank had to pull the punter to the side and be like, hey, man, get it together. But punters are people too. But that's kind of crazy because, I mean, Blacksburg is very rural, you know, and you come from a place that, as far as I know, like I know throughout history, places like tend to lose a lot of their original culture, but I feel like New Orleans did a great job of never losing like their Black culture and all their culture in general, like with the food and like the parades and the festivals, not even like the music necessarily, even though that's a big part of it. But I just feel like it's very culture rich there, regardless of what you're trying to get into. Blacksburg is not that, but it is a hell of a football town.
Oh, definitely it is. It definitely is a hell of a football town. And I was fortunate where I've spent time on college around college football programs before, where I have an uncle, his name is Burton Burns, and he coached at Tulane, then he went to Clemson. So when I was recruited to go to Clemson, he was the running back coach there. And he coached C.J. Spiller and all the guys at Clemson during their heyday of like good running backs. But when Nick Saban went to Alabama, he pulled my uncle from Clemson and recruited him to go to Alabama with him. So he coached at Alabama for 10 years with Nick, with Coach Saban, and, you know, coached all the major running backs you could think of at Alabama. So that's, you know,
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a laundry list of them. So I spent a lot of time around him and around college football players. So I kind of had a good idea of what college football was like. I'd been to Clemson. I spent time there visiting him in the summertime, going to camps there and just spending time with my family. But it was a culture shock in a sense, but it was a good change. And I'm very fortunate for it. I'll tell a quick story about New Orleans and Blacksburg. There was a restaurant downtown when I was in college. I cannot remember the name of it, but I was seeing this girl who was a little bit older than me. And for my birthday, she wanted to take me out. She knew I was from New Orleans. She took me to this restaurant. Boudreaux. There you go. So I remember going in and we're sitting down and the waitress is like, you guys want to hear our specials? And she said, sure, sure. So she's going through the list of specials and she said, and you have to try the gumbo. It tastes just like New Orleans gumbo. Like I've had it the other day. Everyone loves it. It's so good. And I remember the girl I was with looked at her and said, he's from New Orleans. So if it's not, he's going to tell you. And that waitress looked right at me and she said, don't try the gumbo. Everyone else knows. Everyone else thinks it tastes really good, but you're not going to like it. And I said, okay, yeah, I'm not at home anymore. I'm definitely farther away from home than I'm used to being. But I appreciate her honesty, and it was a good night.
Yeah, like, but in your opinion, or in your expertise, your expert opinion, what would you say is like the perfect gumbo?
There's typically two gumbos, a Cajun gumbo and a Creole gumbo. I prefer a Creole gumbo because my family's more Creole. But for me, it's a seafood gumbo that has shrimp, let's see, some crab, thick roux. So like the brown, like soupy part that you would consider is like a little darker. But that and kind of spicy. Like have a good amount of spice in it. Kind of like what we would call a filet gumbo.
Mm. What's the difference between Creole gumbo and Cajun gumbo?
One has like a little more, is more tomato based. So I prefer more of a Creole gumbo.
Okay. I got you. If you had to pick five must-have things to eat with somebody visiting New Orleans, what would be on your short list?
Okay. So five things that would be on my short list. One, an overstuffed shrimp po' boy, which is just like French bread cut open, heated up, maybe buttered, and then you layer a bunch of shrimp on top. But it could also be, you know, roast beef, it could be ham, it could be hot sausage, it could be, you know, fish, it could be oyster, whatever you really want it to be. I prefer shrimp. And that's layered with lettuce, tomatoes, you can get pickles, hot sauce, ketchup. So it's kind of like a hoagie in a sense, but it's more of like a seafood-based hoagie from New Orleans. Definitely gumbo, for sure. It's just a staple dish and serving that we have here. I would say red beans and rice is a big one, which we typically eat on Mondays in New Orleans. It's just rice and beans, but it's kind of soupy a little bit. Jambalaya would be really, really good. And these always can be made, you know, different people from different parts of Louisiana make them differently. But as a general concept, po' boys, jambalaya, gumbo, I would say a king cake over beignet. I'm not a big sweets person, but king cakes are really good during Mardi Gras season. And we only really typically sell them during Mardi Gras season, which they can have different kind of fillings inside of it, cream filling, apple filling. It's kind of, again, like a French bread in a big oval circle with icing on top of it. And then the last thing would be probably crawfish etouffee, which is another, it's kind of like gumbo in a sense, but it's a different flavor, different taste, and a different base. That one is like heavy tomato base. It's kind of like a tomato paste base. So it's more of an orange dish than like a brown dish.
I got you. Yeah, one of my boys, I'm not going to say his name. He knows who he is when he hears this, but he'll get a po' boy. And he'll just ask. He eats everything like plain. He's like a child. He'll get it with just shrimp and bread. And it makes me want to fight every time. Because I'm like, I'm a big like believer in, like, I have a ton of like Latin, like Latina workers. Like, they work for me. They make me their food. I don't alter it. I eat it as is, so I know what it's supposed to be like. And it bothers me when people like bland out their stuff, because I'm like, bro, a po' boy, like, why even order it? Like, just get chicken tenders or something. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. Come on now. But like, red beans and rice, I have had. It's amazing. I was blessed. A family friend, she's from New Orleans. She actually moved back there, but she was in Northern Virginia for a while. And she used to invite me over sometimes when she made like meals for the family. And I got to have some good, like, New Orleans style, like, jambalaya, like, gumbo, just absolutely amazing food.
Yeah. Yeah, it is one of the things that I missed the most when I left home. Because, you know, you grow up there in that culture and that environment, so that's like what you know as food. And I've traveled before different states and stuff, and it's for a weekend or a soccer tournament or, you know, something like that. But yeah, I mean, I really missed New Orleans food when I moved to Blacksburg, to Virginia Tech. But I mean, look, Virginia Tech's got some great food.
Facts.
Don't get me started on a dining hall with the London Broil.
Oh, West End.
Oh, West End. Man.
Yeah.
I used to live in there.
So you get on campus, you know, you're a freshman special teams guy, you're the punter, you're miles away from home. Who on the team really like took you under their wing and were like, hey man, hang out with us, we're gonna show you around and show you like how it works?
You know, I would say there were like three groups. One was the kickers and punters that were there already, which, you know, they're kind of adopting me into their family they already have. So that's Carter Worley and Bobby Peasley. So like they took us in, me and a guy named Kyle Stewart, who came in the same year as me, and Lance Goff, who came in as a kicker also, but played a little back of quarterback as well. They really took us in and kind of showed us the ropes and were like, look, we're a special isolated kind of group of the team. We all stick together. This is a lay of the land. The second group was like my freshman class, specifically Eric Green, who was my roommate in college. My roommate my freshman year, so we shared a dorm together. And then also Mike Daniels and Lance Goff, who I mentioned before, who became my roommate sophomore through senior year. That became my closer network of close friends. But then also, you know, like some of the seniors or upperclassmen on the football team that just wanted to reach out and kind of knew I was the first person from Louisiana to ever play at Virginia Tech, and kind of just on my own, far away from home. And I tell this story about Michael Vick. When I first got there, Mike pulled me to the side after the first practice and was like, hey, you're Vinny, right? From New Orleans? I said, yeah, I am. He said, oh man, it's nice to meet you. I had a great time in the city for the Sugar Bowl last year. And I said, oh, yeah, that's great. That's great. I'm glad you did. You know, New Orleans is a great town. And he said, do you have a ride to the cafeteria? And I said, no, I'm not even sure I even know where it is at this point. Because we weren't eating at West End. We're eating at the other cafeteria. And he said, why don't you ride with me? I'll give you a ride. And I said, all right, cool. So I rode with Mike, and he had like a beat up Honda Accord that had the tent peeling and speakers were blown, and he had to, you know, crank the car a few times. But I rode with him a few times, almost every time that summer, just ride with him to the cafeteria and just ask me questions about New Orleans. I was asking questions about the team. But it really showed me this is a family, and not just, hey, we got a new guy that's not even close to my position. And I'm sitting there thinking, why is this Heisman Trophy candidate, all-star quarterback who may go to the league in a year, talking to this rookie punter who just came from some random city? But it just kind of showed and highlighted to me the camaraderie and how much it meant to be a Hokie at Virginia Tech very early on.
No, yeah, that's a fact, because, you know, like you said, he's not just any starting quarterback. He's Michael Vick. Like, even at that time, like, he was on the scene now. So, like, he was big time. And he just, like, was like, hey, man, roll with us.
Yep. Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, it was very impressive to me. I mean, and I can't speak more highly about Mike than anyone else I know in life, because he's such a leader. And, you know, for people that have not had the fortune to play with him or be in a locker room around him or know him on the behind the scenes, and you just kind of know him from the games or the news and media, he is a fantastic leader and a person that cares about the team and cares about winning and knows that all the parts have to be on the same page to achieve our goal. And he's not an asshole about it. He's just, you know, we signed up for this, and this is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to win. And I have so much respect and love for him and the way he goes about his business.
No doubt. What was your relationship like with Frank Beamer? Because special teams were his baby. Like, that was his thing. Beamer ball, everybody knows Beamer ball. He hasn't coached a game since 2015, and announcers coaching games that have nothing to do, or commentating games that have nothing to do with Virginia Tech, still talk about Beamer ball when somebody makes a play on special teams.
Yeah, it was a great relationship. It was, as I used the word earlier, it was a very professional relationship. So it was, you know, Coach Beamer will let you know, this is what I'm looking for. I'm looking for 40 or 45 yards, you know, a 3-point this, a 4-point that, hang time. And this is what I need you to do. And if you can't, then I need to find somebody that can. But he gives you every opportunity to do it. He makes time for you if you want to talk to him about something. He's very, you know, as a specialist, you know, a lot of our game is very mental. It's not physically hard to take 2 steps and kick a ball or punt a ball. So it's very, very mental. I give the analogy of, imagine you play in the basketball team and you travel with the team, lift weights, ran sprints, practice with the team, but your whole job was to shoot free throws. So if someone got fouled in the game, they pull you off the bench, you go shoot 2 free throws and you go back to the bench. And that's what kicking and punting is. And it doesn't matter how much you practice that for years and years and years. And we see it in the NFL or in the NBA with guys that shoot free throws. You're never going to be 100%, because there's a human element to that that's just very, very difficult to replicate. And he understood that and understood a lot of our game is very mental. So a lot of times coming down on us really hard, threatening us, screaming at us, just wasn't going to work, because we have to be able to focus on what we're doing. And he gave us a lot of space to do that. So it was great working with Coach Beamer. I mean, I'm very fortunate I got to work underneath him and learn a lot from him, and learn a lot from the other guys I kicked and punted with. I mean, we really, you know, spent a lot of time doing a lot of random things. We had this game we played called Punt Golf, where we would take, you know, a bag of balls, about 5 or 6, 7 balls, and each person would get a ball, and we'd have, you know, 2 fields, but there'd be a tower in the middle or trash cans off to the side or a goalpost here, and we would just make a course. We'd say, all right, par 6, you have to go over that goalpost. You got to go over the tower, in between the 20 and the 40 on the other field. And we just make a game. And you can kick or punt. But we're just going to see who's going to win. And the person that lost has some kind of penalty. So we haven't found ways to challenge ourselves and kind of have a good time, but make sure we're staying on top of our skills also.
Is this what you did during practice, or was this extracurricular?
This is extracurricular. I mean, this would be during practice, but you know, we would take care of special teams pretty early in practice and not go all of our pride and joy all very early in practice. And then we had time kind of to ourselves to work on our drills, to work on stuff. But then towards the end of practice, it would be something fun we would do after we kind of knocked out our work that we were supposed to get done that day. We didn't like to just kind of stand around and do nothing. So that was a way to still be active, but be kind of challenging. Because obviously to hit a ball over a tower, you know, you got to hit a pretty high ball, which is no different than trying to get a punt inside a 20. Or to hit it from one field across to the other field, you really got to drive a ball almost like you're on your own 10 and you want to push it far down the field as you can. So there's a lot of skills worked inside of that, but kind of in a fun atmosphere where it's kind of loose and we can still kind of have a good time.
I got you. So once they got special teams out of the way in practice, like y'all couldn't leave, but you had to stick around.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We stuck around. The closest we got to leaving early was we would go start the saunas. Man, it's really, really cold outside. We hit the saunas first for everybody else. But that's like 5 minutes before practice ended. And we just wanted to get in there before everybody else did. So that's about the extent of leaving early. A lot of times we would go down to the stadium and practice in there. Because again, punting is a lot about, and kicking is a lot about mental clarity, visualization. You know, visualize, you know, this is where you're going to be kicking on Saturday. So you might as well practice in there on Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday. I mean, it doesn't make sense to do it on an open field. Do it in the confines of a stadium. We would bring speakers and make sure we blast the music loud and just pretend we're actually on game day. So it's more muscle memory and comfortable for us when it came time for games.
Yeah, no doubt. So y'all didn't get to skip on any conditioning sessions. When Frank was running them, you were running with him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And my freshman year, I ran track in high school as well as played football. And I was pretty fast. And freshman year, I ran 4.34 40. You got to run it three times. I ran 4.34, second time 4.35, third time 4.36. So my average is a 4.35. And I hope, I would imagine I still hold the record for fastest punter at Virginia Tech. But Coach Beamer came to me and said, all right, well, you're running with the receivers now and conditioning because you can do it. Mm-hmm. And in case they need you for a fake punt, I don't want you running with the other guys. But it was a fourth fastest time on the team. And he said, you know, I think I might try you at receiver. And I said, Coach, I'm not sure I want to play receiver. I don't know anything about a route tree. I don't want any contact. I'm just here to punt. So he had me run some routes, and I purposely dropped the ball like three times in a row.
Damn, you sold?
Oh, I did. I was like, Coach, I can't catch him. I just can't catch him. And he pulled me to the side and he said, Vinny, the first thing you do when you punt is catch the ball. I know you can catch. If you don't want to be a receiver, just tell me. And I said, I really just want to punt, Coach. I'm focused on punting. We have, at that point, we have like Andre Davis. We had all these receivers. Like, I'm not trying to get out there and I'm trying to punt and do that very well for us.
Side note, I heard a really funny story about Coach Beamer the other day. UVA fan told it, actually. He said he was down there at the driving range, and Frank pulled up, and he had like a UVA, like the fan had a UVA like cover on his driver or something, or just some of his random clubs. Frank made like a comment about it. He's like, oh, we're playing with the enemy. And he was like, no, you're the enemy. And Frank goes, well, I guess you're not getting any of these then. And he like popped his trunk and it was just full of like Nike golf shoes and like all this new Nike golf stuff. And I just thought it was funny that that Frank, you know, flexed on him like that. But
yeah, that sounds like him. That sounds like something he would do for sure. He always had a good sense of humor about him and in practice. You know, when it was time to be serious, he was on top of us. But, you know, if he's in a good mood or practice kind of lighthearted for us, then he's kind of joking around with us as well.
Yeah, who was your kicking counterpart when you got there? Who was kicking field goals? I don't remember.
It was, so I redshirted my freshman year. And then my redshirt year, when I actually played in the first year playing, was Carter Worley.
That's right.
And then after Carter was Brandon Pace.
Good old Brandon. So you weren't there with Shane?
No. Shane and Jimmy were gone by the time I got there.
That's right. I get my dates confused sometimes. So I have to have people set me straight. What would you say was the hardest place for you to punt on the road?
Oh, West Virginia.
Okay. Is that because of the battery-filled snowballs?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yep. Battery-filled snowballs. I mean, it's, you know, Coach Beamer, before the game one time, he said, listen, make sure you guys keep your helmets on. And I was kind of like, why the hell would that matter if I keep my helmet on? And then I was walking one time, and I just felt like a ding, like smack right across my helmet. And I looked down, and it was like a battery. It just hit me right in my helmet. And then I realized, okay, this is an extremely hostile environment. Like, these people are not half a hair for make sure they win, half a hair just to make your life harder. And it was a night game. I think we were number 5 in the country. And we lost to them that night. And they stormed the field and were just terrorized the players on the field. You know, because their whole job was just to get under your skin the entire game. And they were trying to pick fights with us on the field and everything. And they had just won this big victory over a team they obviously don't like on a nighttime television game where we're ranked, and they beat us and upset us. So that was probably the most hostile environment we were in that I can remember. And when we were trying to leave that stadium, you know, their fans like rocking our bus back and forth. So we had to get, you know, obviously we always have an escort, a police escort to get us out. But we really had to get them to get us out of there because they were just, I mean, hitting the van, rocking it back and forth, just being very unruly. But that would probably be the one I would say.
Yeah, I remember one of my coaches, my position coach in high school, was a big WVU guy. And we played them on a Wednesday night and we lost. I think they had like KJ Harris. I think that was our Noel Devine, one of the two. And I remember practice the next day. It was hell for me because he made me. It was even like a day before a game. Thursday was supposed to be walkthrough day, and he ran my ass because I had been talking so much shit.
I'm not surprised.
But I hated WVU more than I've ever hated UVA because WVU was actually good enough to beat us sometimes. You know, it's like there was a time where that was UVA too, but I just felt like the blood feud and the hatred was way more turned up with WVU than it was with UVA.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I'm going to look it up right now, but when I think I might have punted to Pac-Man Jones when he was there. Yeah, I punted to Pac-Man Jones when he was at WVU. But he's a list of people that, like, I think I had one of those toughest strings of people to punt to, maybe in the history of punting. And that might be. Oh.
What's your list, man? Give me your list.
All right. You ready for this?
Yep.
It's a list of ESPN top 10 plays during college football season. So these are people that you do not want to punt to for any future punters. Well, you won't have this list, thankfully for you, but Pac-Man Jones, Roscoe Parrish, Devin Hester, Reggie Bush, Larry Fitzgerald at Pittsburgh, Cadillac Williams at Auburn. If you want to throw D'Angelo Hall at practice, it's just a crazy list of people that you just never want to put the ball in their hands, like ever. I would try to punt away from them as much as I possibly could. Because between Reggie Bush and Devin Hester, I mean, those are probably two of the most electrifying returners in recent college football history.
Yeah, Miami, Devin Hester, him and Roscoe both, actually. And then Roscoe played for the Bills, I think, but he was hell in college, I remember. And then Reggie was one of a kind. He didn't do shit on the ground versus us, but he got off in the passing game. That's an impressive list. And D-Hall was nasty. But people think about Larry Fitz, like, because Larry Fitz was a big dude. Like, he's tall, but that dude was generational.
Oh, yeah, he was. Absolutely. He definitely was.
Sometimes I forget he went to Pitt.
Mm-hmm.
Him and Shady, both of them.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, yeah.
Man, 57 punts inside the 20 at your time at Virginia Tech. How hard was it to master the art of the coffin kick?
It's challenging because it's, you know, intuitively when you want to punt a football, it's like you want to swing for the fences like you're trying to hit a home run in baseball. Like, that's like, because you just know I just want to crush this ball as hard as I can. But it's tough because the angle of the ball you have to hit it at, and I know punters punt differently now. They kind of hit Australian style with the nose down. They kind of come through in a certain way. But for us, when we punted, you know, back in 2000, you really had to put your body energy more up. So I take two steps and then I go more towards the sky when I hit it, because my body momentum is going to take the ball forward no matter what. It's just, instead of going through the ball down the field, it's more going up through the ball, going straight up, which feels unnatural in a sense until you do it, you know, 300 times. And then you feel like, okay, I kind of got this down by now. Towards the end of my seat, towards the end of my club, I started doing kicks to the opposite side of the return man. So if we're on the right hash, and then I would put the ball towards the left. And that can be a little challenging also, because any deviation on a football with a foot can look like the biggest shank punt. It'll be a 15-yard punt. So it's really, the risk-reward factor is pretty high at that point. But again, once you do it enough times, you kind of get a good feel for it. But it can be challenging. I mean, it's perfect when it works. I remember there was one punt I had. I think we were playing against Temple. And it was Jimmy Williams. So shout out to Jimmy. I heard him on Tales of the Terror Dome. I checked him out before.
Yeah, shout out Dub.
Yeah, shout out Dub. I remember looking at him and I was like, I'm going to put it on one. And he was a headhunter. He's like, the one? And we're in punt formation on the field, like in the game. And I said, just go to the one. Just go to the one. And he was like, okay. And miraculously, I hit the ball. I'm not even sure it turned over. It might have just went like an up spiral, but it landed right on the one and he caught it. And he looked at me and was like, what? And I was like, I know. I thought it was going to happen and it did. Hell yeah. So it was awesome. But when it works, it works. And when it doesn't, yeah, it's tough because you feel like you just missed it. It's almost like you almost hit a home run, but it hit a foul ball. But it felt like a home run, but it was a foul ball. And that's what a shank punt feels like to a punter. It's like, oh, half an inch inside, that would have been the perfect punt. But it was half an inch outside. So now it's a 17-yard shank, and now the crowd thinks I should be replaced next punt. So risk and reward, but when it works, it works.
Yeah, that has to be the hardest part about being a punter, is the fact that nobody ever wants to see you on the field, ever.
Yeah.
And when you do your job correctly, like, it's cool. But if you don't do your job correctly, it's the end of the world.
Right. And the tough thing is that, you know, you practice for that job and put hours and hours and hours every week into that job. And you may only get three or four chances. And each chance is, you know, the average snap to punt time, if you timed it, is about 2.8 seconds. So if you do that three or four times in a game, you're just at 10 seconds of game time, but you've put in 30, 40 hours of work a week. So it just sucks for you personally, because you don't want that punt to represent the work you've done, or you don't want to let your team down or your family down or your girlfriend stands or your friends back at home watching you, or the nation when you're on a national televised, you know, game, where there's 3 million people watching you. So that kind of sucks. But your teammates know how hard you work. They know it wasn't your intention. They know you didn't take a scholarship from a faraway place to come here and mess things up. It's just shake it off, and you got another punt coming up maybe in 15, 20 minutes. So get ready for that one.
Was your list of toughest people to punt to based off of Frank Beamer telling you you better not punt to that person?
A couple of times, to be honest with you. Like, Devin Hess was one of them. I think the last time I played against Devin, it was like, do not put the ball in his hands. Like, just, I don't care if you line drive it and you're average as shit. Do not put the ball in his hands. So I would just sometimes just line drive the ball and try to get it to bounce a lot. We had to chase it, and he wasn't just stable enough to just catch it and run. But that would be obviously more effective than Reggie having a lot of time, catch the ball, make 3 people miss, and then, again, he's on ESPN making plays. So
yeah, plus Pac-Man, you mentioned Pac-Man. Pac-Man was a pain in the ass, man. That dude was good.
Yeah, he was. He was a very good player.
And Chris Henry, rest in peace.
Yep. Yeah, it was a great time to play college football, to play against those guys. Even, like, you know, we played against Cal 1 year in San Francisco in a bowl game. And Aaron Rodgers was the quarterback. And not that I played against Aaron Rodgers. I mean, I didn't punt to him. But I was, you know, lucky enough to play against a lot of great, great players and play with a bunch of great players as well.
Yeah, that's very true. I guess the crazy part is, and I think I got this right, but correct me if I'm wrong. You remember Virginia Tech playing Florida State in the Sugar Bowl. Your dad was on the committee for the Sugar Bowl, right?
Right.
And then you ended your college career in the Sugar Bowl. Is that how that went?
Yeah, yeah. So, like the story I told you earlier about my first high school game was in the Superdome. So, you know, my first high school game, I was 14, very young. I didn't know what I was doing. I just made a team 2 weeks earlier. I had a terrible first game. And then the full circle was to finish my career in that same stadium on that same field, you know, at 21 or 22, as opposed to 14. And, you know, the first time I ran on the field to punt, I had this wave of like emotion run over me. And I kind of had a quick second flashback to me being in my purple and gold uniform in high school, being this little bitty frail kid that had no idea what I was doing back then, to now being, you know, a few times semifinalist for the Ray Guy Award, playing with amazing players, got to travel the country, playing in different stadiums and getting a lot of experience and building a lot of confidence in what I was doing. It was a great full circle moment to come back to where I started my kicking and punting career to finish it in the exact same spot.
Why is it called the Sugar Bowl?
That is a good question. I do not know. I don't even want to lie to you or to the listeners and tell them, oh, it's because of sugar cane. Like, I don't even know why it's called Sugar Bowl. I can Google it for you, but I don't really know.
I thought you might have had the inside track with your dad being inside, using in that position. I thought maybe he might have had some knowledge on that, but I never thought about it till we just talked about it. That was a spur of the moment question.
Yeah, I don't even know.
And that's how ADD works, kids.
I just figured it out. Well, I just Googled it. It's at the time, Louisiana was the only state in the country that produced sugar. It was back in 1927. So,
oh,
yeah.
Okay. Damn. Hey, man. It's like reading Rainbow on here. You know, LeVar Burton would have been proud. We looking stuff up.
There you go.
So your time at Tech wraps up. What's next for you at that point?
So my time at Tech wrapped up. I graduated in December of 04. I moved back home to New Orleans because I was trying to go to a couple of NFL teams and just kind of feel that out and see where it was going to go. I would have loved to play in the NFL and go to an NFL team, but that was never like my dream to do it. And it's actually not typically uncommon for kickers and punters because a lot of us are soccer players first and we kind of fall into kicking and punting. And then you just take it as far as you can. I mean, I'm lucky I got a full college experience out of it. I had to travel around, make lifelong friends, see the country, get some notoriety behind it. But I didn't have like a burning desire to make it in the NFL. Like if it worked, great. If it didn't, then it didn't. But I moved back home. I'd gone to a few NFL teams. And then Hurricane Katrina happened in that summer. And me and my family had to leave New Orleans. We went to Houston, Texas, to get away from the storm. And the first person to give me a phone call to ask if I was okay was Frank Beamer. It was the very first phone call I got. And he just wanted to check on me and my family and see how we were, if we needed anything. If there's anything, you know, Hokie Nation or he could personally do, he'd be happy to do it. And eventually I decided to go back to Virginia Tech and keep training. The home was destroyed. So it was the place where I worked out. So he said, come back to Tech. We'll find a place for you to stay. You can work out here. You know, do everything you need to do. And I did that and it was great. It was a great experience. And then I eventually moved away from Tech and kind of bounced around a bit. I went to Houston, went back to Houston, went back to New Orleans, went back to Virginia. And then from there, I moved to Chicago because the guy that had trained me in my kind of performance training during the offseason when I was in high school in New Orleans and when I would come back home in college was a guy named Tom Shaw, who had trained hundreds and hundreds of NFL players. And I got the privilege of being there every summer to work out with random people like Darren Sharper or Eli Manning or all these players who just kind of came to Tom to get better. And since he lived in New Orleans and my family already had a relationship with him, me and my brother and my cousins were able to go there. And a few times, Kevin Jones came down with me. Mike Emo came down with me. They spent the summer with me and my family at our house. And we went to the camp every day and got better and did everything. But Tom called me when I was in Virginia. And this might be the only time I'll tell the story on a platform where people will hear it outside of my friends. But he called and said, hey, you know, a guy you know, and that guy's name is Cortez Hankton, who is the wide receiver coach at LSU right now. Cortez was working out there, and Tom had a guy in Chicago who was going to run a facility for him, but the guy kind of bailed at the last minute. So Tom was kind of asking around the group that was with him that time, does anyone know someone we can send out there that can take over in the immediate future? And Cortez said, well, I think Vinny is training athletes in Virginia. Truth be told, I was just managing Anytime Fitness. So he knew I was at a gym. I guess he assumed I was training people, but I wasn't. I was just managing Anytime Fitness in South Riding, Virginia.
I know where that is.
Oh, it's by Dulles. It's
South Yeah, I know where that is.
Yeah, you know where that is, yeah. So Tom called and was like, hey, I heard you're training athletes. I want to see you in Chicago. I'm going to pay you this much. You know, you got to go next 2 or 3 weeks. If that's something you want to do, let me know. And I said, sure, I would love to. Knowing that I hadn't trained any athletes, but he made me feel better. He said, look, I'm going to send you the manual, the same thing you've been doing since you were a kid. It's the same thing on Mondays and Tuesdays and Wednesdays. You've done it for years. You know what to do. So I go there, start a new life in Chicago, probably spend a year there trying to get this program off the ground. And eventually Tom comes to me and says, look, I have an opportunity for you in another place, but it's in Florida. So if you want to take that opportunity, let me know. And I was attracted to this opportunity because I would be with a team of coaches around me, a lot of coaches around me. Whereas in Chicago, I was the one-stop shop where I didn't have a lot of education behind myself as far as training athletes. I kind of just taken a job because it seemed like the right thing to do. And it was like, oh, I could pay a lot more money and I can go back to training athletes and be in that world. And it's a new city and it'll be exciting. And I've been in the mode of moving around from Houston, New Orleans, Virginia. So I didn't mind picking up and moving. But this place in Florida was called IMG Academy. So I moved down to IMG Academy probably 2008 and maybe 2007. And I get there. And as Tom described, there are 13 strength conditioning coaches servicing all different sports, golf, soccer, baseball, tennis. And I was really impressed and was very thankful for the opportunity because I got to learn from so many coaches from all over the world that were training people like Maria Sharapova or the NFL Combine guys that came in. So I got to soak up a lot of knowledge and learn a lot about this new craft that I was endeavoring on. And it was great. I spent 12 years at IMG Academy. I worked with most of the sports. I worked with the NFL Combine guys for a number of years. So I met, you know, people like Russell Wilson and all the guys that came there. Luke Kuechly, like it was a bunch of guys that always would go to IMG to do off-season training. I've worked with Olympian athletes. I became the director of performance for the Soccer Academy for a number of years there. So I got to train kids from all over the world. I got to help with the IMG football program, what it is right now, as a high school elite program, where I worked with the kickers and punters the first couple of years because they knew my background was kicking and punting. So I would spend time out there with those guys. And then I got also was picked to travel with a very high profile athlete who probably a lot of listeners on this podcast will know his name because he plays hockey for Washington Capitals. His name is Alex Ovechkin. So I was Alex's personal trainer for, I think, two or three summers, where in his off season I would travel with him wherever he had to go and keep him in shape. So that was in Russia because he was the ambassador for the Winter Olympics 1 year. If that was in London because his then fiance Maria Kirilenko was playing in the London Games then. Wherever it was, or Toronto for a, you know, NHLPA meeting, I would travel with them all over the world and just keep them in shape. So we can do a whole nother podcast about my stories about that. But but that was an amazing experience I got to have through IMG Academy and just putting me out there to take the skills that I learned and help not only the high school age athletes who were our soccer players or the NFL combine guys, but, you know, the cream of the crop top athletes in their specific field. So I left college, went on to IMG Academy, and got to travel the world and work with high profile athletes and build a name. And that was amazing. I really loved that time. And Sarasota, where I lived, in Bradenton, Florida, where IMG Academy is a beautiful part of the country. There's a bunch of beaches. It's great people. It's a great experience.
How much of what you learned from Mike Gentry did you apply to teaching this new wave?
You know what? Actually, a lot. A lot. And a lot of what I learned from Coach Gentry as far as our lifting, because I still have my old football manual right now that I got, that he would send us in the summertime to keep us in shape. I still have that with me to this day. I would use a lot of his discipline and accountability, and even from just the coaches on the football team, because these are young athletes that are 14, 15, 16, 17, that know they want to get somewhere. But when you're that age, although you're in an elite place like IMG Academy, which, you know, you go to school for half the day, you train for half the day, and sports is really pushed to the forefront there. They're still young student athletes, and they still need to understand, if we lift at 7 o'clock, you're here at 6:55. You're not here at 7:10. Like you're here ready to go. So there's a lot of things that they had to that I use from my time at Virginia Tech that I brought to IMG Academy to help instill, you know, some discipline and accountability for these young athletes that a lot of them had it. They had the drive to get where they wanted to go, but they just needed, you know, someone to guide them along the way. And a lot of them worked really, really hard. Some became national champions at their universities. Unfortunately, the one I'm thinking about right now played at UVA, but he was a great kid, but he did go win a title at UVA. And I give him crap for it all the time. But yeah, Tech definitely helped me in that respect as well.
Man, that's awesome, dude. Like, you're like the James Bond of college punters. You do all this cool stuff now. Make it, you know, people like, feel like you're dispelling the narrative about punters.
You know what? The funniest thing is, because when I was in college, I remember making the mistake of going on HokieInsiders.com or whatever it's called, Tech Insiders. And it was after like a spring game or something. And someone said, "This is our new punter, Vinny. Vinny's skinny." And I came to college at like 5'10", 160 pounds. That's a very small frame person for a college player. But now I am 6 feet, 225. And when people see me and someone says, "Oh, you played college football at Virginia Tech." And they're like, "Oh, what'd you play? Running back? Like DB? What'd you play?" And I was like, "No, I was a punter." And they're like, "What?" So I think naturally, if you see me, you wouldn't assume I was a punter. And I did send a tweet to Pat McAfee saying, "Hey, if you ever want to get some cool punters together, I know, you know, Sean King and yourself are pretty dope, but give me a shout. I'm down to hang out." So
that's awesome, man. Are you, so like I mentioned like 4 million times on this episode about like the music in New Orleans, and I mentioned Cash Money specifically because I remember riding the bus to school with my MP3 player, and I was listening to Juvenile because the G Code had just come out, and I was a big Cash Money guy. I love them. But how much are you a big music head? Like, because there's a ton of it where you're from.
Oh, dude, I'm a big music head. And my style, what I've listened to, has changed a bunch. I'm really big into like EDM right now, but like really hard EDM. But before, when I was in college, and I was one person from New Orleans there, and like you said, Lil Wayne was really hot, Cash Money was hot, I would bring back mixtapes. Like when I would go home for the summer, I would bring them back and like burn them for everybody on our team. And I was like the music guy you would come see if you wanted the new Squad mix or you wanted the new Lil Wayne underground mixtape that he released at home, but you couldn't get it anywhere else. You know, this is way before releasing on Spotify and dropping it on Dat Piff or something like that. It was just, I would burn CD after CD after CD for everybody on the team. So I loved it. I mean, I absolutely loved it. So I was a big music head. I still listen to a lot of music. I still go to like concerts and festivals and do a lot of stuff down here in New Orleans. But yeah, that was a big part of it too. I love doing that for everybody on the team.
That's awesome, man. If I looked at your Spotify or your playlist right now, who would be some of the artists that I would see?
Well, if I gave you some of the artists you would see, I can give you some of like the ones that you'd recognize, like Future.
Yeah.
Definitely Future. Some Wayne. I still listen to Lil Wayne because he still keeps churning out crazy bars and hits all the time. But it's pretty eclectic. I mean, it's random stuff like Tiesto, Matrix, Fastboy, random groups that aren't super like big out there, but they make a lane of music that I really vibe to, like Fred Again, you know, sometimes Hardwell, or there's a group down here called Suicide Boys that are pretty big down here. But yeah, that'd probably be some of the ones you'd be listening to on my list. I have a whole like workout playlist that's just like hard music that just makes you want to go in there and just eat weights and just go super hard. So that's my Monday morning 6 a.m. workout list.
That's what's up, man. Hey, Vinny, man, I appreciate you, you know, taking the time out of your schedule. I know you're busy to come on here and tap in with Hokie Nation. You got some interesting stories, you know. If you ever want to come back on, maybe bring Ovi. We'll talk about it. no, but like, yeah, man, no, absolutely, appreciate it. It's been fun, man. I've enjoyed hearing about your journey. I heard some stories I had not heard before. So yeah, man, I appreciate it for real.
Absolutely. Yeah. Look, thanks for putting me on. I'm happy to talk to you. I really do. And you know, the first time we spoke, I told you, this is a great thing you're doing, Daniel, because it's, you know, it's great to feel reconnected with Hokie faithful, because it's a time period in your life that was so important and valuable to you. And although you still watch the games, you go visit games in person and you go back to the bars you go to and talk to the coaches and the new players, you still feel somewhat disconnected from it until you realize there's a platform like this one to reach out to more people than you know. And that's really important. So this has been a great experience for me, and I'd be happy to come back on and tell you what I'm doing right now and just have more conversation with you. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, no, absolutely, man. We'll definitely set that up. We'll do it for sure. Cause I know you got a lot of stories.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me on. Shout out to the Hokie Nation, everyone listening, all my former teammates, all former players, coaches, staff, everyone. I miss y'all. I hope y'all take care and go Hokies.
Yes, sir. Go Hokies.